Well, I hope you've recovered from either getting too much or giving too much love from Valentine's Day. I'd like to say I'm still recovering from both. An ideal world, that's what we want to strive for, right? My name's Mark Farrell. On the Progressive Radio Network, the show is Inside. Happy Thursday to you, my friends. You've seen her on special comedy shows. Probably have seen her live in New York City if you live here. She's always on SiriusXM with Howard Stern. You can hear her with Artie Lang. She's the great Stacey Pressman, stand-up comedian, actress, motivational speaker. What? Motivational speaker? You got to watch out for those people. Syndicated radio host. And she has an eating disorder that she happily shares with students and audiences across the nation. And she's going to be joining us in a few minutes. You know, I just read this again this morning, so I think this is a pretty cool thing. Governor Cuomo, he's a pretty cool dude because this is not the first time that he's pulled over. Yes, he's got, I think, like 8 troopers with him when he travels anywhere. But he pulls over and he helps people in distress. So apparently, now, of course, this could be kind of a media, you know, stunt or whatever, or I don't think it sounds like it's staged from how it's couched, but it's pretty cool that he pulls over and he himself doesn't pick out a cell phone to call AAA, et cetera. He actually gets out there and wants to change a tire. And I think the other one most recently, the car wouldn't start. So he's jumping. Apparently he's very handy, but it says really something about somebody's integrity and character, especially a governor to pull over. And the state troopers would be like, hey, man, I keep you safe, buddy. I'm getting here, my hands dirty here. But it's pretty cool. Good for you, Governor Cuomo. I like to hear stuff like that. Salt of the earth, right? And speaking of salt of the earth, when I speak about anti-bullying at schools, I share a story that really kind of rattles me to the bones. And it came full circle kind of the other day. I was in line at USPS to drop off a box. You know, it's a simple thing, an Amazon return. You know, it's got the label affixed to the box. You just set it on the counter, go, no money exchanged, nothing. You don't even need a receipt. So you should be in and out there in a heartbeat. But there's a gentleman in front of me who was having some issues in terms of trying to find out what happened to his package. Apparently, he sent something back to Verizon. Verizon says they didn't receive it. So I'm starting to understand that he's not really understanding what the woman at USPS is saying. So I'm listening very patiently, and he has his back toward me. And then all of a sudden, after like 5 or 7 minutes, I interjected by saying, you know what, I think she's right. You better not go to X Verizon store. You should call up and tell them, you know, this is the date, et cetera, et cetera. And he looked at me with kind of a long stare, and, you know, I didn't think much of it. And then another few seconds elapsed, and next thing you know, he turned around and goes, hey, Mark. And I'm looking at him going like, hey, here we go again. You know, my got bad eyes. I don't know who the hell you are. So he's like, it's Jerry. And I was like, holy, wow. So this is the guy that I talk about. One of the people I talk about, I speak about a lot of people in my talks, but when I speak about anti-bullying, this is the guy in eighth grade that I bullied once, that I actually pushed against the lockers, that I called him degrading names, and it was the one and only time I had done something like that. And actually, when I tell the story, that when I was actually doing this act, I felt horrific. I felt horrible. I knew it was wrong, but I was doing it because I thought it would increase my popularity, you know, insanely enough. And I felt bad, and I apologized, and I got in trouble for it, et cetera. And we were cool ever since. But you know what? Some things just stay with you. And maybe that's why, you know, I do the talks that I do, because it's important for me to get those messages out. That, you know, maybe if you do something like that, and, you know, in the scope of things, in a macro sense, you know, it's a blip. It's very, very small. I mean, I didn't torment him for weeks and months and years or whatever, but still, if you do it once, it's one time too many. So here I am in the USPS store. He turns around, he says this to me, and I'm like, Jerry, yeah, hey, how's it going? At the same time, I'm thinking like, oh my God, here's the guy I talk about. Can I, you know, open up to him and tell him? Here we are in the UPS store. There's a line for me behind us. I'm like, hey, come over here. So we start chit-chatting. And I realized when I pulled in, there was one car next to me with one person sitting in the car because I got out closest to the passenger door, and she looked at me, and I'm like, oh, I bet you that's his wife waiting for him. So we're talking, hey, what are you doing? Because the last time I'd seen him was probably like, oh, maybe 10, 12, 14 years prior to this. And he was working in a like a Jiffy Lube, you know, those very quick oil change, 15 minutes or less, they change your oil. And hopefully when you drive down the street, the oil doesn't come flowing out of your car. Not that Jerry would do that, but, you know, some of the stories I've heard about those places. Anyway, I digress. So we're talking, and I'm thinking in the back of my mind, like, can I, you know, come clean with this guy, Jerry, who, you know, we were cool with through high school. But, you know, that time in seventh or eighth grade when I did that to him, you know, I felt like a complete imbecile, I don't know, a complete ass, embarrassed that I could possibly think that I would have the power or the right to do that to someone else. So we're walking out to the car. Hey, I say, let's walk out. We're walking out together. And, you know, I never knew his diagnosis. So, and I still don't. He looked pretty good. He said he had a stroke. He was about my height, maybe a little bit less. Maybe he's like 5'11", 6 foot. He looked pretty good. And I asked him about his brother, his younger brother, who died from a heart attack. So I'm like, oh, my God. So there's no way I'm bringing up my talks that I share with audiences about what I did to Jerry years ago in eighth grade. So we're walking out to his car. I'm like, oh, is this your wife out here? He goes, no, it's my fiance. We're getting married next year. I'm like, that's great, Jerry. Congratulations. I'm so happy for you, man. I'm really, you know, proud of you and all the things that you've done. And it's genuine. I'm not pouring it on because I felt like I still had more making up to do. I did that the last time I saw him in that Jiffy Lube place when I was like over tipping him to, you know, grease the car. But so I met his fiance, and she's very sweet. And again, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking like, oh, can I tell him? I'm like, no, this is not the time. So they're saying that they're getting married in 2018, I think in spring of 2018. Of course, me and my big mouth go, oh, do you have anybody doing your music? And they're like, no. I'm like, well, you know, I used to DJ. I used to have this business called Profound Sound. I'll take care of it for you. And they're looking at me like, wow. That's great. I'm like, yeah, don't worry about it. You know, we'll work something out. Don't worry. You know, meanwhile, I'm thinking in my mind, like, yeah, I'll just do it for free, you know, or a nominal cost if I have to have an assistant with me. Because I guess in the back of my mind, I am still trying to make up for what I did, you know? So it's crazy because it's a good thing because, you know, it shows that we are all, hopefully, made of, you know, good integrity and character and decency. So, you know, even though I did something pretty effed up, you know, a long time ago, I still feel like I have to pay penance. Anyway, he's a good dude. I'm really glad I ran into him because it's just important. You know, he's just a sweet guy, you know, pleasant and seems to be kind of happy-go-lucky. And despite his struggles with his disability, I'm not sure, again, of what his diagnosis is. But, you know, it's irrelevant. It's not important. It's none of my business. The fact is that, you know, I ran into him. And the fact that I was a bully and a complete ass to him, and he's still civil with me. Again, you know, everything was fine for all those years afterwards, but still, it lingers with me still. And I guess I'll make peace at it, and I won't make a toast and embarrass myself at his wedding, if that's what you're thinking. I can see it now, like the wedding singer too, like, oh no, take the microphone out of this asshole's hand. This is not good. So anyway, I'll keep you posted on that, but I told my wife that, and she's like, really? Wow, that's wild. So did you tell him? I'm like, no, it just wasn't the time, and I will. I got his phone number. I texted him right away because actually I had his wife, his fiance. And this is kind of cute because I was genuinely into this man. I had her take a picture of us. And then I texted him a few minutes later. Hey, so great to see you. You know, let's stay in touch about your wedding plans, et cetera. You know, be happy to help out. And he wrote me back. Yeah, great to see you. So I'll be able to stay in contact with him. And maybe, I don't know, maybe something will hit me next month or two or three. And I'll say, hey, you want to grab a cup of coffee? And say that to him, and we'll see where that takes me, you know, in my head. Maybe just putting it out there to him will make me feel better, and then I won't have to DJ his wedding for free. No. Just kidding. So I was really disenchanted lately, you know, about something that I'm really, really excited about. You know, you guys listen to the show here, Insight, fairly regularly, if not regularly. If you're not addicted to it, I can't see why you're not addicted to it. But, you know, I'm a cyclist, outdoor cyclist. Even though I'm visually impaired, you know, I don't run into things, moving objects, only just like big oak trees. That's why I have a very flat nose. Anyway, yeah, I teach spin. You know, I just love it. Can't get enough. So the Tour de France, yes, I was all into the Lance Armstrong thing the first year, second year, third year. And then I started getting a little, you know, concerned, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, the whole thing about doping, we've been there, done that, and especially since Usain Bolt. Oh, no. Jamaica's own got caught, tested positive for banned substances. So guess what? There is a new form of cheating out there for pro cyclists. Ready? You can't make this up. It's called mechanical doping. So no. People aren't taking syringes and shooting them into the bicycle seat or the center tube. Get this. This is way better. You can't make this up. There are little motors inside the tubes. Unbelievable, right? Crazy. So, you know, I read about this on a cycling website a couple months ago, and it's a very credible site. I think it was Velo, V-E-L-O News. And I was just taken aback saying, wow, I mean, to what extent do professional athletes, and I'm not just, you know, targeting cyclists, well, I am targeting cyclists right now, but I mean, in a macro sense, I mean, to gain any ounce of whether it's shedding weight or speed, time, it all comes down to being the fastest and best, the most elite in their craft, right? So here I am thinking, okay, the doping thing's kind of under control. You know, it's random samples, and if you place, you get, you know, doped, checked, and there's all kinds of provisions, and they've cracked down a lot. But now, you know, with this information that's been whispered about actually on the sideline since 2010, like, hey, I think there's something going on here, because they're showing footage, actually 60 Minutes, who lost a little bit of credibility with me in the last couple of years with, you know, I'm sure you agree. But anyway, they show this footage of some cyclists crashing, right? You know, when you were a kid, you come home, you get off your bike because, you know, kickstand when you're a kid is, you know, it's invisible. You don't use it. You just let your bike go. It falls over. And what happens? The back wheel or the front wheel goes, right? The back wheel. The front wheel doesn't make any noise. It doesn't have any gears or bearings. But what happens is when you see these bikes tumble over and skid down a pavement, guess what's going on? Not only is the back wheel going, the crank is moving. Cranks don't move unless they're powered. I mean, they may move a little bit because the gravel's taking the pedal and moving them a quarter or a half turn. But this baby's moving. So you see this cyclist like, oh, my God, I got to get to my bikes. So nobody sees these cranks still moving around. Oh, my God. So I'm looking at this thing going, holy shit, this mechanical doping thing is for real. So they had Tyler Hamilton, who was Lance's former teammate, actually one of his best friends, until he started saying, listen, this is not cool. And he actually is the first one to be a whistleblower in the whole doping thing. And the snowball started exactly. And by the way, there's a great documentary called or a movie called The Program, if you're into watching anything about the cycling doping world of professional sports in terms of the Tour de France, The Program. I think it's produced by, directed by Ben Foster, if I'm correct. But I'm not correct about much, except, you know, so hopefully if the one time today I'll be correct, it would be about that. So check it out. So here's the thing, you know, you got these cyclists who are, you know, putting their bodies through torture. I get it. I totally get it. And I understand that you want to keep at least at par with the field, because you're training 10 months out of the year, 11 months out of the year, different parts of the world. You're trying new methods, spending incredible amounts of money. Your sponsors are. And your sponsors want results no matter what professional sport you're in or even amateur sport. I mean, you need results for your country. And in certain countries, if you don't get those results, you know, there's hell to pay. And maybe you won't see your family again, et cetera. You know, we've heard those stories in China. But I digress again. But here we go. You know, these athletes are pressured. And it's very expensive. And I kind of can understand how, all right, here I am. I'm going to pretend I'm a professional cyclist. All right. I know on my team, well, I won't use a team example because I think everyone has to be on board, but there's another team that trains in America, right? And we know that two or three of them have these bikes with these, you know, motors in them. And so the motors, going back to Tyler Hamilton, I'm sorry, I started talking about this and I guess I got on a funny tangent. They're very, very light. The only way they can be determined or found is if actually the bike is weighed. And they actually weighed a bike's team. All the bikes get weighed. And there was one team last year in the tour. I'm trying to remember what team it was. It's a European team, but all the bikes were heavier. And an ounce or two or five or, you know, on a bike is huge because you're always going for the lightest possible speed. So they can, what they want to do is impose rules, sanctions, where you can actually take off a wheel. A back wheel should weigh between, you know, kilograms, et cetera, and a front wheel. So if there is any excessive weight, then, hey, let's X-ray this thing. Let's find out where the motor is. So if you're on a team and you know another team is doing it, then you know that by Tyler Hamilton saying on his 60-minute special about this mechanical doping, that he said, yes, this could definitely prove to be beneficial to a cyclist, especially in a tour, to give you a little bit of a break. You know, if you're about to go up, you know, one of the Pyrenees Mountains, and you can kind of pull back like maybe 20 or 30% for 10 minutes, I mean, that is huge. When the other guys are pushing, well, we don't know how many other guys are really pushing. So that it's a big benefit. So now here I am, a cyclist on a team. Maybe another team's going, well, you know, our sponsor's thinking about, you know, pulling out after this year unless we get the first top 10 slots, or maybe the first 8, or maybe the first 15, whatever the case may be. So I do get it. But then on the other hand, there's got to be guys out there and women, athletes who are purists, that say, no, I won't belittle myself and kowtow and give in to the scrutiny, the backlash, and the reality of cheaters and legitimizing it by saying that there's too much pressure to perform and win. It's got to be tough. I'm not saying it's easy at all, but the reality is, look at Usain Bolt. I mean, let's just end with him because, you know, America and the world seems to love him. One, what's not to love about the guy? Yeah, he's full of himself, but why wouldn't you be? You know, you're the fastest man on earth, but you have an enhancement. You know, you put it possibly a needle in your arm, your leg, your butt, who knows where, and he's shooting himself with banned substances. You know, it's kind of like if we found out that Bruce Jenner became... No, that's not a good point. If we found out Bruce Jenner really was doping when he won a decathlon back in the 70s, late 70s, right? Yeah. I mean, he was an American or an international icon and still is on that level. You know, I still can picture the picture of him on the Wheaties box of him winning the decathlon. And then there's a picture of, like, in 2014 when they show him on the picture of Fruit Loops. I just think that's hysterical. So, I mean, you know, it just goes to show that it's whatever field you're in terms of being a professional athlete, it's not easy. It's not easy at all. So I take my hat off to these guys for numerous reasons. Number one, for just being able to be so devoted for a lifetime to dedicate your life and your body and your time, your family, your social life or lack of, you know, whatever the case may be. You know, but the reality is, you know, mechanical doping today, it's been, you know, EPO and doping for the last couple of years. You know, what could it be next? You know, you're going to have an invisible bike that you can switch on and off. You know, I don't know. Cars are going to be driving themselves in 5 years. Jesus Christ. What the hell is the world coming to, Stacey Pressman? Oh, my Lord.
Driver's license, so I don't know.
So I had the pleasure a few years ago of hosting a great comedy event with my friend Maria Melito, who's on a great New York City rock station, Q104.3. And it's called Laugh for Sight, hosted by, or actually developed and founded by, Brian Fisher, who's a good friend of mine and individual who has vision loss and has been dating his dog. Actually, I think he's engaged to his dog, Nash, now. Yeah. I think I got a wedding invite, but it was done in like paw print. So I'm not exact. I have to get it deciphered somehow. Anyway, I had the great pleasure of meeting Stacey Pressman a few years ago. Stand-up comedian, actress, motivational speaker, syndicated radio host. You probably heard her on Sirius multiple times with Mr. Stern. How often does he get called Mr. Stern? Artie Lang, of course, great dude. And she talks about being an eating disorder survivor, which is great. I love the fact that people are putting out their hurdles and what they've overcome in life. And she's got a sweet, sweet smile. Stacey Brossman, welcome to Insight on the Progressive Radio Network.
Wow, the Progressive Radio Network. We're very progressive here, and thank you for having me today.
That means you have to keep your clothes on.
Unlike the other shows I do.
Because it is hot in here. The engineers kind of do that. I don't know whether it's Gary Noel who likes it hot in here, but, you know, it is kind of warm in here.
Oh, cool. Oh, Gary Noel talks in here.
This is his network. This is his baby.
Oh, I didn't know he has vitamins, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You want some?
Yeah. I need vitamins. Bad.
Well, we got a little black market thing going on here.
Oh, good.
Here.
Okay. Yeah. I'll take
After
some vitamins.
After the show, we'll talk.
I need some.
So the life of a comedian.
Oh, it's very exciting.
Started possibly at the age of, what, 10, when you were trying out for the role of Annie?
Well, I was in, actress thing. I did that thing.
But that was a major changing point. I mean, how many people, when they're 10 years old, have a divide in their life that really kind of sets a new trajectory? Please tell us what happened then.
Since the age of five, I can remember, I wanted to be a singer, an actress, I don't know. I didn't want to be a ballet dancer. I was terrible at dancing. But I wanted to be a performer. Mostly, I was probably a singer first, believe it or not. And then
That shows.
Oh, it does. Thanks.
Yeah. I don't really sing.
Like, I don't sing professionally at all. But, I mean, I will if you hire me, guys. But I don't sing it like I want to be in some kind of I couldn't yet verbalize it. But whatever was in front of you was Annie, because that was what young girls performed in. When you would see a show, it was Annie back in the 70s and 80s. So that was like sort of like what my goal was back then when I was like 10, 5.
And you auditioned?
I auditioned at the Alvin Theater on Broadway. It was very exciting because we had a
very
big...
Very exciting.
It was actually a sort of like, they had the American Idol call, mm-hmm. open calls. That's what it was. It was sort of millions of people there. And I sort of like got in, I cut the front of the line and said, I can't breathe. And then like they let me in and I got to audition and I like sang my heart out and I got a call back, and that's a whole other story. But there was another young little girl's agent said to me, oh, you have a good voice, but there are no fat Annies. Because I was like a little chubby kid. I wasn't like humongously overweight, but I was like a little chubby. My mother overfed me a little bit too much cookies. So
out of love, I'm sure.
Out of love, because when you don't give enough, you have to feed. Bad Nabisco products. So anyway.
High fructose, baby.
High fructose corn syrup right in these veins. And, Oreos are highly addictive. So he said there's no fat Annies, and I got really upset, and I thought about it. There are no fat Annies. She was an orphan during the Depression, so I might have been a little orphan Fanny and miscast. Then I developed sort of like a complex, and I told my mother about the fact that, he said this to me, this agent, and she kind of put me on this diet at age 10, and I never got off it since.
So how does a 10-year-old supposed to deal with that? Did your mother kind of correct what she said?
Well,
or she went along with it by putting you on a diet?
I think I was very demanding. My mother is a very strong woman, but I'm like the one who made her take me to the audition. Like I was very, like I knew what I wanted. It wasn't like I had parents pushing me. They didn't want my parents didn't want me to go into this business. They're very supportive, but they didn't, at that age, they didn't want me to have anything to do with show business at all. I mean, I wasn't even allowed to go back to the callback, believe it or not. My mother didn't take me to the callback. She told them they weren't interested.
Were you crestfallen?
I didn't know about it until recently.
Recently? Are you kidding me?
It came up in, not recently, in the last couple of years. Yeah, it came up and I was like devastated.
Wow.
They called and they said, we'd like to see your daughter again to, come back for the second call back. And never happened.
Well, how does that make you feel after all these years thinking there's no fat Annie, but then you had a call back that
you didn't
know about?
This is how crazy life is. It wasn't the casting director saying that to me. It was some other young girl's agent probably trying to psych me out or just being an idiot. It wasn't the person that was even looking at me for the part saying, well, she's not right.
Sure. But as a 10-year-old, you can't compartmentalize those
things. I don't know those
things.
Of course not. Everyone's any older person, in the back of the theater was a big deal for me. Like I didn't know. Everyone was very self-important and you know, how people are when you go to these things. So I didn't know. And that affected me. It affected how I viewed my body. And I had no vision of my body prior to that. I didn't understand what fat meant. It didn't have a real meaning deeply emotionally. You know, it wasn't I knew it wasn't a good thing, mm-hmm, quote, sure, unquote, but I didn't understand how it would affect somebody. So,
so you that know, began a 15-year cycle?
Oh, longer than that. But yeah, it was, it never really, you know, like my self-worth was valued on like my weight. I mean, now it's stopping, of course, because I know I'm smart, but sorry, not smart, but you know I have more to offer in life, but than my weight. Hopefully I do at this point, after all these years of being on this planet. If I don't have more to offer, I'm really in trouble, right?
And exercising till physically exhausted.
Yes, I've done that. And I still get into habits where, like, if I eat too much, I'm like, I've been at the gym too long. I mean, they're not terrible habits, mm-hmm, but, you know, I still have a little bit of that I see I have to catch, you know?
And it's stated that you never sought professional help. You thought and still probably feel that you are in charge of your thoughts and actions.
Well, I did have professional help.
Oh, you did?
Of course.
Oh, but I misread that. Oh, hey, bad producer.
I didn't get help until later on. I mean, I had help. Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. Glad to hear.
You know, it was interesting because it wasn't specifically, it surrounded anxiety, and that brought into the, it was funny, I went for help for anxiety and I got sick, but it was weird how that was really, there's like the core of these illnesses of eating disorders, addiction. There's always either some kind of mental illness underneath, trauma.
Feelings,
exactly. Anxiety for me and a bunch of other stuff. But I think bringing that, you know, healing that will heal the addictions or the disorder. I think that's the primary. It's not the addiction that comes first. You know, but sometimes it could be. Like people get pills for their back, and then they're just physically addicted to the pills they have for their back, you know, and then they become opiate addicts. And that's like nothing to do with addiction, you know, in terms of psychological issues. A lot of times it's just purely physical. So it can, that's my theory on addiction.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I agree. And was there a turning point for you when you ended up in the ER from taking too much Tylenol or aspirin because you gained an ulcer, you developed an ulcer?
Well, I had an ulcer in high school and then that was serious, but I didn't go to the hospital. I went to this regular doctor. But when I got older, I had a major panic attack and I was dehydrated.
Aren't they fun, panic attacks?
Oh, I get them a lot.
Oh my
right
God.
Bad. They're severe.
I've had some brutal ones.
And they come sometimes out of nowhere, but now I know when they're almost like seizures for me. Like they're not seizures, but they are like that.
Do you have a Richter scale rating? Like, that was a 9. Oh, that was only 3. That's not bad.
I mean, I could tell if it's from this is what scares me. If there's from a specific thing that I'm like suppressing, mm-hmm, the panic attack, or is the panic attack coming from like just out of nowhere?
A general one.
Yeah,
like a general anxiety.
I have generalized anxiety, but I'm used to it. It's almost like you're used to it.
I'm raising my hand too.
Almost like you're used to it. Like it's like depression. It's like
you have to wear it out.
Kind of used to being depressed, and I'm not like a depressed person, but I always know that feeling. So when I'm not depressed, like it's weird. You know, it's almost like, but I live with it. It's like having any kind of like disorder, like diabetes. Like you live with it, you know how to deal with it. Like I should have my pill or my sugar, my shot, you know. People know it's like depression's the same thing. Like you kind of live with it, and anxiety, like you learn how to live with it to the best of your abilities. You balance your energies, you take your vitamins, you know, it's a lot of, you know, upkeep. Like any disease, mental or physical, there's a lot of like personal, you know, responsibility in that, I think.
Absolutely. Has living with depression made you a better comedian dealing with adversity?
I don't even know. Like, not really a better. I'm not the comedian that, I don't even know why I became a comedian. Like, it doesn't even make sense.
All right, but, so I don't have to ask you that.
No, I don't even know. You know, people ask me, why do you become a comedian? I just kind of came. My dad, may rest in peace, he was very funny. He was like a kind of guy who can like spurt off jokes one after another, which drove me nuts and I hated it. But I guess I got that from him. I liked very edgy comedy as a young girl. Like I watched Richard Pryor like more than a 10-year-old should, you know, or 11-year-old should. I liked very, very edgy comedians, you know. I even watched Carrot Top, if comics will beat me. But I used to, because he would always be on TV, and mm-hmm, Wendy Liebman, I remember watching, and Jean Garofalo. They were always on TV, so I would watch these comedians. And I'm like, oh, I'm Joan Rivers, of course, and I didn't see myself as a comedian, like, ever until I got to do it, started doing it, and then I started seeing myself as a comedian. But I think I just went into it because I just wanted to have a voice of my own. I was always reading other people's scripts, doing acting, and anything else I did, it was always somebody else would write a script and I would do it. Now I'm writing my own script, sort of, and making jokes. And I was always the person to put a punchline, like, to, as a self-protection, even during, like, I would always try to be funny. Like, you know, that people do that. You know, they hide behind humor. So I guess I learned to take that and hone it, because, you know, stand-up is really a craft, you know.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
An art, it's a
huge
writing
skill.
Craft.
Yeah. Execution,
have,
timing.
Yeah, all
obviously
that.
Material.
Obviously all that stuff that people need to have.
Is it cathartic for you?
When I'm on stage, I guess I feel good. You know, it does. When I'm on stage, my anxiety is off. I don't have anxiety on
stage.
It's
so funny how most people, the anxiety gets ramped up.
No, it's like there's a little bit of like the, you know, the physicality of having,
sure.
you know, the adrenaline rush mm-hmm. in the beginning or whatever. But once you get into a flow, I really feel connected to my higher self, if that makes sense. I feel connected to my, you know, that other,
absolutely.
That universal
sure.
consciousness that connects me to the audience, and I feel one with them. And it's a very special feeling. And I do it when I'm speaking, and I do it when I'm doing my stand up. And acting too, when, you know, once you get the lines and they're really there, and you know, you don't have to worry. That's it comes in that when I'm working, I'm very connected to my higher self, and that I do realize that.
And most actors and actresses and comedians find that part addicting. That's why they can't give it up,
right?
Or it makes them great.
Well, yeah, it is. There's something addicting about it. I could also like withdraw. Like I'm a kind of person that withdraws a lot. Like, so I'll be home. You know, a lot of people run to do spots, and I'll be like, I don't really feel like going tonight. But once I'm there, I'm like happy I'm there or something. That's how I am. Like,
so. Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting point because a lot of comedians are like, oh, there's an open call here, or so and so's Galifianakis is pouring over there, and we can jump up on stage or whatever. That's not you. You don't need to rush there.
Right. I mean, if it's, you know, like I have friends that will like go in snowstorms to do a 5-minute spot, and I used to be like that. I guess I should do that more. But it doesn't, you know, certain types of spots don't excite me, you know. But if they're, like, really, like, if they have a good cause, or it's a really good, you know, club that I really like doing, or it has to, you know, other things have to come into play. Good money always helps, you know. So, but it is, to me, a job, too. So I always consider my performing life a job. Like, it is my profession, and it's a job, so I treat it professionally. It's not a hobby. So it has to have the elements of what a good job has. Does it make sense?
Oh, absolutely. But it seems like, you know, it's like when you're a writer. Being a writer and a comedian and an actor, I think, are very closely aligned, because it's not like when you walk out of here, you see things differently. I think you notice nuances, whether it's funny, it's sad, it's indifferent, because especially in New York City.
Right.
I mean, there's material between when you leave the studios here at Progressive Radio Network to the subway or walking home. I mean, you can gain probably some good material, you know, on a good any day.
Yeah.
And that's what's kind of neat. So it doesn't really turn off, because innately that's how you're wired, like your father. I mean, it genetically predisposed just to seeing things in a certain way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, and I can make jokes out of very dark things or very light things mm-hmm. or stupid things, like I'm in Gary.
Is there a preference?
I don't really know. It's whatever inspires me. It could be very silly things that will.
You talk about your divorce a lot.
I do. I don't talk about it as much. I mean, certain shows I do. It depends on my mood. I'm a moody comic, so I'm like, oh, I don't really feel like talking about that right now. And I'll change premises, but keep the jokes. Does it make sense?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
I do
yeah.
that a lot. So what a joke might have been about my ex-husband, I'll just make it about somebody else, because they all it's all the same thing.
Sure. So I guess
they all fit the same.
So I guess your ex-husband doesn't have to feel you know, lack of confidence of his anatomical size below. Anymore,
right. Exactly.
Because it could be anybody. X,
well,
he's
a comedian too. So
oh,
he's I'm sure he's had a lot of jokes about me that he still does. But
have you seen each one of you? Have you both seen each other perform after your divorce?
I haven't many.
Interesting.
No, I haven't seen
consciously.
Him. I don't. He lives in LA, and I don't.
Oh, okay.
Really.
All right. So it's not around.
I mean,
corner.
We're not enemies. I just don't hang out with him
sure.
anymore. I don't hang out anymore with him. I don't see him anymore. But yeah, I mean, I can get inspired by like all these, like, you know, I think motivational speaking is really fun, but then I get really. I think it's really corny too, if you take it out of context, like honor yourself, rebalancing your life energy. You know,
well,
like what is it? I mean, I get it. Like I'm reading these posters and they're really funny, but
yeah.
I can make, you know.
Yeah, well, like, I make fun of Gary. You know, you got to make fun
energies.
Of Gary.
And of course. You know, energy is a very, it's not tangible, so people, you know, have to buy it. They don't buy it.
I started speaking, motivational speaking, about 5 years ago, and I still have a problem with the actual couching of the title, the name, motivational speaker, because I just speak about me, overcoming adversity, and a lot of different things. But if it motivates people and empowers them, then, well, I'll deal with the, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, I think telling a story motivates people, like telling your story.
Sure, which you do so well.
Oh, thank you.
And you've been nominated by a college speaking bureau twice as a top speaker.
Oh, thank you.
Twice in 2012 and 2014.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
That must be quite rewarding. I mean, to be on stage.
I never wanted to do that. It was an accident that I got to be speaking. A very dear friend of mine, Mike DiStefano, may rest in peace, talked about his story. He had HIV and he had drug abuse, and he was thriving. Like, he was on the top of his career when he passed, but he was a comedian. And he's like, my agency needs somebody to speak on eating disorders. Will you speak? And I just said, all right. Because we had a conversation about bulimia, because he had a joke about bulimia. I think it was like his joke was, this is quoting him, I'm misquoting him, that I dated a girl. She said she's bulimic. I said, what country? Where is that located? That was Mike's joke. I love him.
Well, the sad part nowadays is that could happen.
Right. People don't know anything.
No, no. Well, let me look it up. Let me Google bulimia.
Yeah, it's a country in Eastern Europe that is now spying on us. Anyway, in Connecticut.
Off the coast of Connecticut. We were just talking about that today. Isn't that crazy? Don't you think we're digressing here that international waters would be less than 30 miles away?
I didn't know that.
No, it's 30 miles. We just looked this up before because we're dumbfounded. You would think it'd be like 100 or 500 miles away. It's not.
We all own the
water. You could swim there.
That's scary a little bit.
It is scary.
Sarah Palin could actually see Russians now. Well, she could see Russians at Brighton Beach, but
well, she wouldn't be able to identify as Russian. She'd be able to see a mass of something. Oh, there's a humpback whale. So, do you find it as a woman that you have different challenges or goals to be up on stage, and do you find it that you have to be more funny and have fresher material when competing with men?
I don't see myself competing with men or women. I just compete with myself. I know that sounds
that's the way
I am. But sure. It does. There is some. You know, I guess you call it sexism in like these with some bookers, I guess. Or maybe they're not. They don't think girls are funny, or they like certain. You know what? Everyone has their own taste. Mm-hmm. You find your own. I don't even think about my. The only thing that bothers me if I have to go on stage and I have my period and I'm cranky. But that's so.
Now, will you tell your audience that you have a period and you're cranky?
But I'll tell them I'm cranky. I can get very cranky on stage. But someone said, you're a very mean lady. I'm like, I'm not a mean lady, but someone once said that to me, and I thought that was
But that's
funny.
Your shtick.
I don't even know that's my shtick. I'm actually the nicest lady in the world, but sometimes on stage the mean lady comes out. That's my bravado, I guess.
Well, I think that has a great opportunity here in the greater New York area because, you know, you can have an edge and get away with it.
I guess so, you can have an edge. I've traveled. I actually have performed in almost every state of the union except North Dakota and South Dakota because there's not really many clubs there. But if there is, I'll come down. But I've been down south, deep south, like where there's no Jews, and I'm a Jew. So, you know, everyone wants to laugh. I mean, there's a common denominator with laughter. Like I think with humor. Like they may not, you know, some crowds may not be as hip to certain things or some. The word hip, I hate that word. But you know, they all have different. Like I think everyone just wants to laugh. You know, we all laugh at sex. We all laugh at like relationships. We all laugh at, you know, politicians on either side of the aisle. So I guess you know, there's definitely people are not. You have to give them a lot of credit. You know, it's not just New York. New York is filled with people from other places. So if you think about it, it's not. You know. Sometimes New Yorkers could be uptight, too.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt. Now you starred in the award-winning film Glam Trash.
That was funny. I did that when I was really 2000, like the year 99 or 2000, I think we filmed it.
Channeled your inner hooker?
No, I played myself, actually. I played a hooker.
Inner hooker. Yeah.
Inner hooker.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
I played a struggling actress. My friend.
Hence the reason why you're dressed like you are today.
Right.
If this was only TV,
sweatshirt.
You could see. Stilettos, eight-inch stilettos.
Yeah. Some people come into radio like with these hooker outfits. But, no, my friend Greg Scarnici, who is actually an associate producer, a producer at SNL now, wrote the film. He's very successful. He's a big YouTube star. And it got a distribution deal. It was my first film I ever did. I was a lead role, and they put me on the side of the box. They put me on the side of the video box at the time when DVD when VHSs were, you know, in style. That's how long ago that was.
When did you realize that your career was taking a turn for the better?
I thought you were gonna say, I actually thought you were going to say worse.
I'm a motivational speaker. I got to be positive.
No, yeah.
Was it with the help of was it Stern or Artie Lang?
No. That was a different, you know, in my 20s, I was a working actress. I was in Grandma Sylvia's Funeral, which I might actually go do in Florida. Actually, I think I'm doing it starting, I'm going down to March 20th. So towards the end of March, April, we're going to have a run at the Boca Black Box. So if you guys are down there, I'm going to help direct it and stuff. I did that show my whole entire 20s, pretty much, my 5 years of my 20s. So in the 90s. And, that was my first time after graduating college working as an actress full time. Then I did 3 films. When I got my SAG card, they were all like principal roles. One was a lead role. And then, you know, I felt like it was like that was an upswing. And then I kind of took a little break to rebalance my energy, as it says on the poster, and for about a year. And then I just started
slowly. Is that when you became a yogi?
Yeah, I became I sold gym memberships at Equinox, and I needed to take a break because I was working my entire 20s as an actress, either struggling and I did a show called Love Hurts when I was 21 when I graduated high school, college. It was about the John and Lorena Bobbitt musical.
Sure.
And it was so raunchy and it was so weird. And I came out wearing a penis hat, like a penis costume. And it was the craziest thing. My boyfriend's parents at the time came. They thought they were seeing the opera. They came in suits, and she was wearing a gown, and they brought me roses, long stem roses that you would buy a ballerina. And it was like a theater that was 5 floors up in the, in the East Village. And it was smelled like piss. And it was the funny shit.
Wow. I guess the one question that comes to mind was the penis costume ribbed.
I don't know. It wasn't. It was a just very
texture.
Lewd. But it did have a condom on its head. Okay. And it was the most ridiculous. And it was such a crazy play. But we had such a good time. So I did that for a few months. And then, I would audition and stuff. And I was just and then I got this show, Grandma Sylvia. And then I did that for years. And I did it, I did mostly in New York. But I opened the Philadelphia production of it. And I did, I actually went down to Florida for a week and did it for them. It was really fun. Down there. So yeah, but I was mostly in the New York show, and it was my life, it was my family for many years. So, and then that show closed, and that was a big step, and then I went to just do comedy. And I guess Howard Stern, I guess being on the show a couple of times, I haven't been on the show that many times, but I did it 3 times, and it was fun, it was good, it was good for me, I guess. Yeah. And I did a lot, I do a lot of radio. I do
your own podcast,
my own podcast, the Stacey Pressman Hour. Just Google it, you'll find it. And I just do guests on people's shows. I've been on pretty much every radio show there is. Pretty much almost every radio show that's, with Shock Jockey, I guess.
If you could do comedy 3 nights a week in the city, would you?
I do. Yeah. I mean, it's fine. As long as the weather is nice.
When you look at the world we live in, the political environment, the unsteadiness of it. From what I've seen of you, I've seen you about 4 or 5 times. You do a lot of personal, which is great. People can relate. Self-deprecating material.
Well, you see me do the blind laugh for sight.
Yes.
And so if I'm doing a long set, a 45-minute hour, I talk about, how Donald Trump was my landlord in the 70s. You know that, right?
No.
All right. So when I was in the 1970s,
what color was his hair then?
My parents, my mom lived in this apartment building on Ocean Parkway. Donald owned Beach Haven, which she didn't live there, but she lived in the fancy apartment building on Ocean Parkway comparatively, because he owns all these apartment buildings. He owned, I don't know if he still does, probably not. They're called Trump, they were Trump owned. And so as a kid, I was they only lived there for, my mother. And when I was a little infant, Donald would come with his father to get when the lease was being signed, if there was an issue in the building, they'd come by, they were landlords, So they were in my parents' apartment a lot, It was really weird. So
can you imagine that?
And my mom would say,
you were the future leader of the free world.
Isn't that weird?
Yes.
But his father was, I know he has a bad appetite, but he was nice, at least, pleasant.
Did he try to date you back then?
I was an infant.
Again, did he try
he didn't
to
grab
date
my, okay. He didn't grab me, but.
Oh, good.
He was kind of like the young son that was kind of like schmucky, you know, when the father's the businessman, the son's like following him around. That was the thing, the way my parents would like sort of put it. They liked his father was a gentleman, you know, at least when he came into the house and all that stuff, you know. And Donald was kind of the, you know, the douchey guy. And that's true. And my mom told me that story way before he ran for president, you know. So I have that history. And then I have a lot of like 6 degrees of separation with the Donald Trump thing. So the other thing is like the makeup artist who accused him of sexual assault was my makeup artist when I got married, Jill Harth, who's actually a really wonderful woman. So I know her. Then my friend Andrea, her cousin is married to Chelsea Clinton. So during the elections, it was very like 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah, sure.
It was like everyone, you know, it was like too close for comfort. It was
bountiful
like,
material.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't talk too much about it, but I did talk about Donald being my landlord a lot. And I thought that was interesting.
So you know how America is just obsessed with crime? You know, how many, you know, starting back with Hill Street Blues and way before that.
Oh,
you know, we can't get
SVU.
Enough of NCIS. I mean, any acronym in the world. The same thing
Criminal
is true.
Criminal Mind. I love that show.
Same thing is true for comedy. You know,
you think they're obsessed?
Oh, I think so, because we need to laugh. Don't we want to laugh, especially in times of, you know, depression and things aren't that great. But even when times are good, everyone wants to laugh. Everyone has to blow off steam. And this coming Sunday, there's a new show coming on HBO called Crashing.
Actually was on the podcast when Artie.
No kidding.
When I did Artie's podcast.
Fantastic.
Artie Lang is, I think, one of the stars.
Yeah.
And
Judd Apatow's show.
It looks great.
Pete
and
Holmes.
Pete Holmes, he's a wonderful, sweet guy. And we had he was on the show when I was guest hosting. And it was so much fun. I hope it looks like it actually captures from what the trailer shows. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the show, and I have friends in the show. Hopefully, I'll get an audition the next season, because it'll definitely go into the. It definitely captures a certain aspect of stand-up that people don't know.
Mm, absolutely.
Like, he's starting out and he's barking. That's when, you know, new comics, like, bark to get tickets on the street and they get stage time. I don't know if they do as much, but they still do that. There's that whole culture. And I think he's trying to capture that and struggling and, you know, whatever his story is. I don't really know his whole story. I know he got divorced and that it starts about that. That's according to the trailer about his divorce. And
yes. Yeah. And his whole downward spiral. And it's about obviously the comedian lifestyle. And I was thinking about you and your divorce. And like, obviously you're not alone because, you know, hundreds of thousands of people get divorced. But I said to myself, wow, you could have certainly been Louis C.K.'s wife in his show, his first show on HBO.
I love the actress in that. I love Pamela Alden. I love her.
Yeah.
She did a show, another show, her own show. I forgot the name of it now. Better Things, I think. Better.
Yes, you're right.
I loved her on that show, Pamela Alden. I would love to have been, you know, Louis C.K.'s wife on his next sitcom or his next show.
Hey, Stacey, can you hang around for like another 5 minutes?
Sure.
I have another guest we're going to introduce right now. And I'm going to say goodbye to you in a few minutes.
Absolutely.
But hang out.
I'll hang out.
I had the pleasure of meeting a few months ago a great, great couple called Team Willody. And they consist of Corinne Willody and Jack Willody. And Corinne and Jack did something crazy. They are actually the New York State champions of the 2016 National Bike Challenge. That was from May 1st to September 30th. They rode a combined total of 23,783.1 miles in 153 consecutive days. Crazy, crazy. But that's not why they're on the show today, because they were on in October to talk about that. They are here today to talk about a new children's book that they have produced, and they sent me, and I read it to my two children, and they are still sleeping for the last 5 weeks. The Dog Who Saved Pleasantville is the name of their new book, and I have the pleasure of speaking to Corinne. Hello, Corinne.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. Happy Thursday to you, my dear, and congratulations on the fruition of your hard work.
Thank you so much, and thank you very much for having me.
Available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's got great graphics that you have done, and I didn't know you were such a... I guess maybe you did all these graphics while you were cycling 80 miles a day on the back.
Some of them.
That's crazy. Yeah. So obviously this book is about making wise and educated food decisions for children, also for parents, because a lot of parents, you know, we grew up in a situation that we weren't really aware of what high fructose syrup was, processed foods, et cetera, daily caloric intake. So all these different things come full circle in your book, which is great because you can read to your child, you know, when they're going to, you know, end their day. And it's great because maybe they can start their day in a nutritious way. And I found it to be very, very wholesome and insightful, because you got the family aspect, you got the nutritional aspect, and you got the community aspect. And it's a great book.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we started it because we work with clients every day who ask us questions about, you know, how to get their kids more, you know, into more healthier lifestyle choices and more active, or how do they stop drinking fruit juice or juice boxes or chocolate milk and all these things. And we just found there was a need for something a little different to capture children's imagination, because, you know, you can tell them everything, but it's not the same as if you get them involved in a story that, you know, it takes them on a journey. And people fall into bad habits all the time, or I like to say habits that don't serve them, and they don't understand why, and then they don't feel well, and they don't know what to expect in terms of feeling good. Most people don't know how good they can really feel. And it's all innocently happening to people every day because of the bombardment of media, you know, all the different things that are out there for people to access that don't really personally resonate with people. So we felt that this was something really special. My husband came up with the idea, and, you know, we started collaborating on it and started the process. And it's very exciting to have it out now. So we're very pleased. I'm very happy you like it.
And getting back to the sugar aspect, I mean, it's so ubiquitous. It's so easy for kids to live on it. But now we're finding out, you know, more and more information how sugar. And my father, this has a point here. My father was an alcoholic for like 30 years, and he kicked it. But he gained a lot of weight because, you know, alcohol has so much sugar in it, and your body craves sugar. And there's so much new medical findings that prove that, you know, it is an addictive source.
Actually, you know, it's unfortunate because 1 in 3 children are obese right now. And if that doesn't change in the next 10 years, 50% of our children will be obese. And it's because of the high fructose corn syrup, the sugar. And sugar, we joke about sugar being addictive, but it's really addictive. It actually is extremely addictive. And, you know, it's kind of, your body doesn't have a threshold for it. So you can just keep eating it. I mean, it just doesn't say, oh, I've had enough now. And just you keep developing more tolerance and wanting more. So it's a really scary, slippery slope.
And then diabetes is knocking on your door.
Absolutely, absolutely. And our healthcare system, you know, we spend $150 million on obesity and obesity-related illnesses. So, you know, we got to start thinking about the future and what kinds of things we want to, you know, how do we want to guide ourselves into a better situation? And, you know, this book was something that, you know, it was, I just really feel that we did a lot of research. It's definitely a need, and we've gotten a lot of great feedback, so we're very excited that this could possibly help people realize where they're at and inspire them to want to change, because it's a fun story and it's non-judgmental and it's not something meant to it's really meant to just take you on a journey and give you a good sense of how people fall into these situations and how to get out of them.
And open doors, you know, open people's eyes to understand that, you know, this is what's out there. And it doesn't cost that much more, you know, to be a parent and to provide more nutritious food, et cetera, and certainly in a fun way, especially when you say Cato, that's your dog, who's actually one of the characters in the book. you know, you can bring that into real world life situation. I mean, I have no doubt this book will be successful. I mean, last year in 2016, you both received the President's Volunteer Service Award for hundreds of hours of volunteer work, certainly on and off the bike. And you guys do great things. And the production of this book that's available online now, and also Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and it's also going to be ebook as well. And I got to talk to you about doing a Audible book as well, because, hey, maybe I would love to read that for you.
That's pretty cool.
And
that's
this way, I don't have to, like, read. I can do, like, a ventriloquist act for my kids, and I can just play the audio and just move my mouth and fall asleep before they will.
I'm sure they'll very much enjoy that.
Corinne Willoughby, half of Team Willoughby, thank you so much, and all the best to you, and I hope you sell tons and tons of books.
Thank you so much, Mark. Have a great day.
Just say no to sugar. Stacey Prussman. So on that
That's
note,
awesome.
I mean, you know, as a person who has struggled with weight and food issues, et cetera, you're on board with that.
Yeah, I think the problem is kids don't move. That's the main issue. They can't burn the sugar off because they don't move their asses. Excuse my language, but I don't want to say asses on here.
You're allowed to.
Okay. They don't move their asses. No one, they're on their phones or on their computers. They're on their Xboxes, whatever people play nowadays, and they don't move. And they don't exercise, so they're going to get obese. They're not going to burn the sugars they're eating. You know, we had sugar when we grew up, but we exercised.
We played outside until it was dark.
Yeah, and then my mom would scream, "Stay in the house!" You know, it's and my mom would cook. Like, that was the other thing. My mom would cook, you know, a protein, a potato, a vegetable, a salad, and
balanced.
You know, yeah, it was balanced. Yeah. And now people just order in crap. They have, you know, all the fast food, and they just, you know, it's different. People,
and everything can be delivered to you. The fad diets, all these different things which you talk about.
Right. And it's like, that's the problem. It's people aren't moving and people aren't cooking. And all this, you know, that's the problem.
That's why we need to laugh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We need to laugh at ourselves.
So where can people find you?
On the streets of Manhattan. No,
yes,
StacyPressman.com, StacyComic.com, at Stacy Pressman, Twitter. Follow my Facebook page, Stacy Pressman page.
Any movies coming up? Any projects you're working on?
Yeah, I'll be going down to Florida to do the show. So,
that's right.
Yeah, so check me out. I'll have the dates, and I have shows coming. I'll be at Saturday at Broadway Comedy Club.
Comedian great Stacy Pressman, honor to meet you.
Thank you so much for
sharing your story here today, and to all the audiences on the comedic stage and also in a serious manner when you're talking to colleges, because you're doing a great thing.
Thank you.
Love it. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great day.
Thank you.